you can't say Jesus didn't exist. If you walk into any university campus, into any history department, and say, I don't think Jesus really existed, you will not get a job. Serious people don't believe this. The historical data leans towards and suggests that Jesus was a real person.
Let's just get straight to it, right? So if somebody were to ask you and they were to say, like, first of all, how do you even know Jesus was like a real person? How do you know it's just not a made up, he's not a made up person? What would you say?
Well, there's a bunch of ways you can answer a question like this.
Okay.
Okay, there really is. But we need to establish a number of things, I think. You know, it's kind of like in any sport, you always have the rules of the game, like stuff you can do, stuff you can't do, stuff that are definitely out of bounds, like in boxing, no low blows. But there's a bunch of stuff you can do, like you can hold, right? And any sport, you got rules of engagement. Yes. And so I like, when I have conversations with people, I like to set the rules of engagement. So I would ask them something like, you realize I can quote the Bible in conversations like this, but I'm not going to quote it as the Word of God. I'll just quote it as a historical resource. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And Christians need to realize that. Now, there's a difference between saying, well, I believe it because it's the Word of God, and I know it's the Word of God because it says it. Like, that's circular reasoning. You can't do that. But if I were to say the Bible makes certain claims, well, then that leaves it up to academic research of whether those claims are accurate or inaccurate, or whether we should trust it or not. And my response would be, like, if I quote the Bible and you tell me you can't, I would ask you for reasons why I can't. If any Bible scholar, conservative, liberal, Christian, atheist, quotes the Bible as a resource, that means I can quote the Bible in this conversation. Are you okay with that? And it'd be whether the person says yes or no. That's an approach I would take.
So although I think I get where you're going with that, in this basically saying that, I would, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I would imagine you would go and then say that the Bible is somewhat of like a history book in itself.
Correct.
If that statement were true, I would imagine somebody who has the question of, was Jesus a real person, would not accept the Bible as a real historical book, and would almost look at it like, if I have a Harry Potter book, how could I just say that Hogwarts is a real place? Right. You know what I mean? So, like,
absolutely.
So what would you say to that person to even to back it up?
Like, I would tell them who agrees with them. That's a serious scholar on the matter. There's no one on the planet, virtually, maybe there's one guy, two max, who think that the Bible is a completely made up book. Or at least, like, instead of just saying the Bible, because we're talking about Jesus here.
Right.
We can just boil it down to the Gospels.
Okay.
Right? So just for the conversation's sake, for it to be more, like, solid.
Okay.
Is there any New Testament historian, New Testament scholar, and I mean any, I mean Christian or non-Christian. So tell me the best non-Christian New Testament scholar on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Arguably, that's a guy named Bart Ehrman.
Okay.
Okay? Does Bart Ehrman think Jesus never existed? No. He thinks Jesus was a real person. And even he would say, if you walk into any university campus, into any history department, and say, I don't think Jesus really existed, you will not get a job. Like, this just is not a thing. The idea that, what's called Jesus mythicism, by the way, that Jesus was a myth, like made up character.
Yeah.
Is just, serious people don't believe this. The historical data leans towards and suggests that Jesus was a real person. Now, that doesn't mean he was God. That doesn't mean he was the Son of God. That doesn't mean everything in the Bible about him is true. It doesn't mean any of that stuff. It just means there was a guy 2,000 years ago named Jesus who did a number of things, and his followers ended up worshiping him as God. That's all that means. It could all be false. But you can't say Jesus didn't exist. That, to defend that position, you are completely outside of the realms of any historical, like, inquiry. So let me put it this way. And I love this one because, because I like this example specifically, because my philosophy background.
Okay.
I compare these two characters a lot. Okay. Socrates and Jesus. Socrates is arguably the father of philosophy. Okay. Now,
okay.
In philosophy, we have Socrates is used kind of as our marker, like Jesus is with the calendar. Okay. So whenever you're studying historical philosophy, you say pre-Socratic philosophers and then Socrates and afterwards.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So he's the guy that separates the pre-Socratics from the post-Socratics, right?
Okay.
So, oh, cool. So let's ask Socrates. Did Socrates really exist? I've never met anyone who said Socrates didn't exist. Like, you can't walk into any
respectful
institution and say, I think Socrates was a myth. And people are like, yeah, cool. What are the things we know about Socrates? So did Socrates write anything down himself? No. Everything that we know about Socrates, almost everything is written down by Plato, his student.
Mm.
Okay, cool. Plato tells us Socrates essentially went to a prophet, right? The oracle at Delphi. And the oracle at Delphi said, Socrates, you're the wisest guy, and not the smartest, but the wisest man in all of Greece. And he goes, essentially, I'm not. There's this conversation. And the reason why Socrates is because Socrates actually admits he knows nothing. That's the journey. How did Socrates die? So Socrates is martyred. He's killed for the sake of philosophy. So he is brought up on charges before the Athenians for corrupting the Athenian youth and being an atheist. Now, being an atheist in that day wasn't the same as atheist today. The charges were he denied the pantheon of the Greek gods. Socrates still believed in like a creator deity of sorts, it seems like. But he denied the Greek gods. So they said he was a atheist, right? And he was corrupting the youth. What he was doing was essentially going around and asking young people why they believed in the gods.
Mm.
And whether they had good reason to believe in the gods. And how do we know that we know anything? Like, these are the sorts of questions. Like, he would publicly go around to the marketplace and be like, hey, can I ask you a question? Like, how do you know that's true? And that's doing philosophy, essentially. But he essentially, they offer him to he can say he was wrong. He says no. His friends say, hey, we can get you, like, out of the city. He says no. He drinks poison and he dies. Like, that's what we know about Socrates. So he's considered a martyr for philosophy.
Wait, he drank poison knowing it was poison?
Yeah. Yeah, like, he...
Okay.
Yeah. All right. He like martyred himself for the sake of philosophy. And so everything we know about this guy is predominantly written by Plato. Now, Plato ends up having a student named Aristotle. Aristotle ends up being the teacher of Alexander the Great. Mm. But these are the big three in philosophy, right? Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. What's the earliest writing that we have of Plato? Right. Now, clearly he wrote earlier, but what's the earliest copy that we have? It's about 700 years after Plato existed. 700.
Oh, wow.
And I think if the numbers haven't changed and we haven't discovered anything crazy, I think we have about 49 copies worldwide of Plato's writings about Socrates about 700 years later. But nobody goes nuts over this. Nobody goes, no, Socrates didn't exist. Plato didn't exist. It's all made up. Now, scholars in studying Plato will say things like, well, we see a projection of Plato's thought in the sense of like, there's like Plato, earlier Plato and later Plato, which makes sense. Everybody is reasoning and they're going to grow in that. Sometimes scholars will even say, well, we think this is authentic stuff from Socrates that Plato puts in the mouth of Socrates. And then there's some other things where they would say, we think this is Plato putting his ideas in the mouth of Socrates. So there's debate amongst what are called Platonic scholars, right? Okay. Like, so people who studied Plato, which is fine. But then I want to compare that to the New Testament documents.
Let's do it.
So, okay, cool. Did Jesus write anything down? No. Jesus didn't write anything down. Did his students write anything down? Yes. It seems to be the case. What's the earliest document we have of something one of Jesus' students wrote down? 120 to 170 AD is the earliest fragment we have from the Gospel of John. That's pretty early.
In comparison to the 700 years.
Correct. By the way, in comparison to stuff we have from antiquity, period.
And when you're saying this, just so people understand, what you're saying, when you give that 130 after death of Jesus, what you're really saying is that's not when the papers were written. That's just the oldest physical copy.
Correct. Yeah. And what we have is even actually like a really tiny fragment from the Gospel of John.
Got it.
But that's fine. Even if we didn't have that. In the second century, so let's just say early 100s to late 100s, we have a bunch of church fathers that quote parts of the New Testament in their writings. Because these guys are writing letters to churches. They're writing letters to one another. And then we look at their writings and then we compare it to the New Testament documents. And we go, they're quoting Peter or they're quoting a portion of the Gospels. So it's for sure the case that these things were written before 100 AD. So even though we have the first copy of the Gospel of John in 125, it's written before that because they would make copies of copies of copies.
Of course.
Right. And so we have really early writings about Jesus. Now, even like someone like a Bart Ehrman, he would agree with the dating of, say, 1 Corinthians being in the 50s AD.
Yes.
Well, 1 Corinthians is dated in the 50s AD. And Paul in 1 Corinthians is quoting from a song or a hymn of sorts about the burial, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Then that means that's an earlier thing he's quoting from. And they'll take this even earlier and they'll think that like that hymn about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus is written probably about 2 years after the death of Jesus.
Okay, so then let's say somebody would say, all right, okay, all right, Arthur, I get, let's say Jesus was a real person. When, first of all, my struggle with reading the Bible then becomes, it's not like the Bible is written like a history book is, where it the claims are of things that we've seen, right? Like, I haven't read all this, like the studies of Socrates. But I would imagine they're not saying that Socrates rose people from the dead. They're not saying that Socrates healed people from being blind and things like that.
Yeah.
So then now that the Bible has history and what may appear as magic also in the same right. book, how do you then prove that Jesus not only was a real person, but did the miracles that he spoke about?
Yeah. So I think a lot of times we get sidetracked with these conversations. I think they're very unnecessary, okay? Because I don't think it's really like my job to sit there and prove to you that Jesus raised Jairus' daughter and he did this, you know, turned water into wine or something like that. Because we have nothing to compare it to other than the text that it's written on, right? So what I would say is, just focus on the resurrection of Jesus.
Okay.
So here's the way I would work it backwards. And Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 15. Look, if Jesus did not rise from the dead, our faith is vain. It's useless.
Yeah.
Okay. And Paul says, let's just go eat, drink, and be happy. Like, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, let's just go party it up.
Right.
Like, the purpose of life at that point becomes enjoyment.
Yeah.
But if Jesus did rise from the dead, that means there's a miracle. That means it validates the stuff he taught. It validates the disciples he had. And so they become trustworthy on the matters they wrote about him.
Yes.
And that means God exists. Yes. That it means God has the ability to guide and protect his revelation to people. Yes. It just means a bunch of stuff.
100%.
Okay.
Okay.
So I think we focus on the resurrection. Did Jesus rise from the dead?
Can you prove that?
Yeah. I think it depends what you mean by prove.
Well, Can you back it up as like history is backed up?
Yeah, right. That's a very good point, because a lot of people use the word proof in a mathematical sense towards things that are non-mathematical questions. I mean, can I prove? This is why I brought up Socrates, that Socrates really existed. Like, what would it take for me to bring you bones and for you to do research and say, yes, these are the bones of Socrates? Like, would you even be able to do that? Probably not, right? So lots of conjecture in the midst of that. Okay. And I think we view historical stuff in a historical sense, and we should view non-historical stuff in a non-historical sense.
And the the bigger the claim, the more, like, proof people are going to need, right? Because, like, sure, like, yeah, because if you say, Julius Caesar was a real person.
Yeah.
And I read that in my history book. Well, okay.
But he's an important guy.
He's an important guy, but it's like, they're not saying that Julius Caesar was God. You know what I mean? So, yeah. Like, or resurrected. You know what I mean? So, like, I'm just saying I understand why people want.
Oh, I trust me. I get it.
Even in the Bible,
Thomas. Yeah,
Thomas. He was there. He was like, look, if I don't see Jesus right now,
yeah.
So I'm very.
But like I get it. I get that people have natural and rational objections.
Yeah,
it's normal. It's weird stuff. Like, I don't think Christians are sitting there saying, yeah, you know, like, people just resurrect left and right. We don't believe that.
Of course. Yeah.
Right? No. And so we get it that people are going to have issues. I would say we all have these issues. So the question really becomes whether the evidence suggests a certain conclusion or not.
Yes.
And if it doesn't, then that's fine. Okay. And if it does, then that means you got to make a certain sort of decision.
Yes.
Right?
And I want to announce, I like how you're honing in on the resurrection, because it to your point, if you can validate the resurrection, yeah, it in a way validates the rest of the miracles and other things as well as the whole purpose of the faith and things like that.
Yeah, because then you look at Jesus saying stuff like, hey, this is the purpose of the Son of Man, to come, be betrayed into the hands of sinful man, and be killed and rise on the third day. It's like, oh,
yeah,
he did it. No, literally. Right? I mean, that's one thing to say that. It's another thing to do that, right? Because it's like such an out there statement. So I'd say, cool. What are the claims that we know? By the way, this is not my genius.
Okay.
I'm not a genius.
Okay.
Okay. This is predominantly the work of a scholar named Gary Habermas. Gary Habermas is probably the best scholar on the resurrection of Jesus. He's a Christian. And this is called the minimal facts approach. So here's what Gary Habermas likes to do, is he goes, I want to give credit to the people that are as least charitable to the Christian claims as possible, but still within like the academic rigor, right? Mm. So he says, what are the things that people can give me about Jesus that I'll take? Mm. So like he existed, right? That he had students, there were claims that he did miraculous works.
Claims.
Yeah, not that he did them, but there are claims about him.
Okay.
That his students had claims. That he was killed under Pontius Pilate.
That's a historical fact.
Yeah, that he was killed under Pontius Pilate. Yeah.
Backed up outside of history books outside of the Bible.
Yes.
Okay, we'll follow him. Let's go.
And that a number of days after he was killed, his disciples went around teaching. He physically came back from the dead and ascended into heaven.
Okay.
Those are claims.
Okay.
Right? Like, people grant these claims.
Okay, so people, and that last one is interesting. So, like, the apostles actually being people who...
They really believed this.
Really believed it. And then, so then what about the apostles' death? Because I know that was something that...
Yeah, so the sixth aspect of the minimal facts argument is something and they were willing to die for these claims. Mm. In various places around the world.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's like, cool. Okay, let's work with that. Let's work with that. So what is the claim? What is the major claim? Well, Jesus is killed. He's placed in a tomb. People know where the tomb is. As a matter of fact, we're told the name of the guy who owns the tomb, Joseph of Arimathea, who's a politician, by the way. right? Like Joseph of Arimathea is in the Sanhedrin, which is the political ruling officers, representatives for the Jewish nation. And so he's buried there by Joseph and by Nicodemus. Both of those guys, by name, it says it. The cool thing about this is, if it says it by name and you write it down in a book, people can go, of that generation, can go, we should maybe ask Joseph and Nicodemus whether it was actually them in their tomb. So they can go verify it instead of them making general claims like he was buried in some tomb somewhere. So these are internal clues that we get that we should pay attention to in the literature. If you're coming up with a lie, why name people? Right? Like, I don't know, like, your family situation with brothers and stuff like that. But, like, if I was going to come up with a lie, to my parents, I wouldn't come up with a lie and bring my brother into the conversation. Because then that, you know, then my parents go to my brother and go, did you guys do this?
Yeah.
And my brother goes, no, I was playing. And then I'm caught.
It's more opportunities to real-time fact check.
Yeah.
It's like if I were to say, the president of Puerto Rico is me. I'm the president of Puerto Rico. Yeah. People could clearly say,
yeah,
that's not true.
Easy.
Okay, so I get what you're saying.
Yeah, and so the Bible has a lot of these clues within them. Names, places, locations, and locations like the burial site, or where something happened. Mm. Jesus went from here to here. If the people, by the way, this is very interesting. So you'll get claims like Jesus went from this location to this location. And then you get some scholars saying stuff like, oh, the Gospels were written 200 years later. But those places, they didn't have access to those places 200 years later. So how do they know those two locations existed 200 years later? Right. So there's a really, really cool scholar. His name is J. Warner Wallace.
Okay.
J. Warner Wallace is a cold case homicide detective.
Oh, wow.
In L.A. Brilliant man. He's written a number of books looking at the claims of the Bible, specifically the resurrection and the New Testament. But he's looking at it from the lens of a cold case detective.
Okay.
So he's really good at his job, by the way. You can go look at his track record and the cases he solved off of like the randomest stuff.
Oh, wow.
And he's looking at it and saying, what are the clues I can piece together? And he was an atheist who studied this stuff and ended up becoming a Christian.
Wow.
So go read his books. He's got really cool books out there. It's cool reading his books and listening to his lectures because he'll notice things that you and I like just don't.
Mm.
And some of it is the stuff that I just mentioned.
As a cold case detective.
Yeah.
When you don't have that many clues, but you're able to kind of like piece together what really happened.
Yeah, it's like so-and-so said that the guy who killed the woman was wearing an orange shirt.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, we missed that in our original investigation because the guy we arrested 2 days later had an orange jacket in his closet, right? And so they didn't make the connection.
Yeah. No, yeah.
And then 30 years later, they're like, whoa, how did you guys miss this one? And they revisited and figured stuff out.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of stuff.
I'm following.
And we pay attention to that stuff in the Bible. Because if you're coming up with a lie, why put yourself in that situation?
100%. Okay.
So it needs to be paid attention to. Names, especially names and places. So here's what we know. Jesus is killed under Pontius Pilate. He's crucified. He's buried. 3 days later, there's people running around saying he came back from the dead. Now, if that took place, what would be the best way for them to just destroy this Christianity thing before it gets going?
Say that he didn't really...
You can say that. But the best thing probably would be to go to the tomb.
Oh, of course, yeah. And prove that like he's still here.
Go drag his body out.
he's still in here.
Bring it into Jerusalem and say, what? Who?
Yeah, he's clearly dead.
Yeah. So the other thing I'd like to say is there's a better lie. Like, why put yourself in a situation where you are coming up with such a hard lie to prove? Because the claim is he physically rose from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
There's a better lie if you're coming up with a lie. And it's that he didn't physically rise from the dead. He spiritually rose from the dead. Because nobody can prove that wrong.
Well, then you didn't really rise from the dead.
Yeah, but it's like, oh, it's a spiritual, it's a spiritual experience we had. That validates this. And like, nobody can disprove it. Now, the way I like explaining this is it comes from a philosophy mind exercise. And it's called the pink elephant in the lobby.
Okay.
Okay. And so suppose you and I were traveling, staying in the hotel. I go out for dinner. You stay in. I come back. And I'm like, I come back and I'm like, hey, bro, you won't believe what just happened. Like, what happened? I was like, on my way up, there was a pink elephant in the hotel lobby sitting down on his laptop just working away. And you're like, no way. That's one of those crazy ideas. I go, dude, we go downstairs right now. You see it? I'm right.
Yeah.
You go, cool. We walk downstairs. We have two options. You look at there and you go, there's no pink elephant. To which my response is, dude, I must be one of those really, really special people that can see the pink elephant. And you're not one of them.
Oh.
There's no way you can falsify that. You can't convince me I'm wrong. Because what are you going to say? I can't see it. Then I'm going to tell you, well, you're not special. Like me.
Yeah.
Okay? What's the other thing that can happen? You say, hey, I can see it.
Yeah.
I go, dude, you and I are both special. It's other people who aren't special. So, if the disciples were coming up with a lie, this would be the perfect lie. Jesus rose from the dead spiritually, not physically, and he appeared to us special people, his students, those who loved him, and those who were with him till the end. And you guys don't know him, don't see him, because you hate him, right? You guys are the ones who killed him. And so if they go and bring the body and show the body, we say, well, we never said he physically came back from the dead. We just said it was a spiritual experience. There's no way they can prove this wrong. And they go on their merry way. They preach whatever they're preaching. And they start a religion like any other religion has started in history. Mm-hmm. Some kind of a claim on some kind of a spiritual experience.
Yes.
Okay, cool. But they don't do that. They come up with the hardest thing to prove. He physically rose from the dead. So the people knew where he was buried, all the leadership, all the people they're in competition with in the book of Acts. And they're telling him, stop saying this stuff. And the Bible records the first counter theory to the physical resurrection.
Which is, what was it?
That they stole his body.
Oh, yeah. Which I would think.
Yeah.
If I were in that time, I'd be like, no, you guys just took his body somewhere. And yeah, so cool. That would be my immediate thought.
Cool, but why? Again, let's just assume they're coming out with the fake story.
Mm-hmm.
I would still stand by my story that they just say spiritual.
No, like, I do see, I didn't think about that. So I do see what you're saying with like they could have came up with a better lie.
Yeah, because now they're risking their lives. So, but if every time you're going to risk something, the payout has to be bigger. Think about it. Like any business you do, any life decision you make.
There's an incentive.
There has to be a bigger incentive.
Yeah.
It would be very weird if you're like, hey, man, give me $300,000 to invest and you're going to get zero.
Yeah.
It's just because you like me, yeah. Right? And if you're like, give me $300,000 and the payout's going to be 10 bucks, you're like, it's not worth it. It has to be bigger. So here's what the disciples would have to have done. They would have had to go and steal the body.
Which is hard because they were guards.
Correct. So now they are going to steal the body of Jesus from soldiers that are the most well-trained military force on the planet. So, I don't know what your background is, bro, but I'm 38 years old and I got a gut. And even when I didn't and I was not like that, it would have been very hard if you said, hey, you got to go take down these five...
Two UFC fighters. Yeah,
or these like five Green Berets or like the best military
Navy
force.
Seals. On the,
like dudes that can kill you with like random stuff. Right?
Yeah.
This is what the Roman soldiers of the day are. They're the best military force. They're always on guard. They're always in training. By the way, they are also in Jerusalem, which is known to have regular uprisings. We know from the historical record that Pontius Pilate had a letter written to him by Caesar telling him, dude, I'm sick and tired of these uprisings. The next uprising is going to cost you your life. Mm. So Pontius Pilate is on edge. Everybody's on edge. Nobody wants an uprising on their hand. Mm. Okay? There's a big military presence in Israel, in Jerusalem specifically. So they're going to have to go. They don't really have weapons because it was illegal for the Jews to have weapons. So they wouldn't do these uprisings. So these guys got the weapons, the shields, the armor. Like, what are they going to fight with? Daggers, kitchen knives, pitchforks? Like, what? Sharpened farm tools? The fishermen, I'm sure they have knives.
And if they kill them, like, let's say they just had, like, guns, even though they didn't. But let's
sure.
say if they were to kill the guards, then it's obvious that you robbed the body because the guards are dead.
Correct. Yeah. But they're not.
But the guards didn't
die. The Bible says, at least, the claim is the guards come and then they're like, hey, like this happened. The stone was rolled away. We had this experience. And the opponents, the religious leaders say, we're going to essentially protect you from your boss, which is Pontius Pilate. The reason why there's a protection in place is because if you're a Roman officer and you lost something you were guarding, it was the death penalty. Mm. So there's bribery that happens in the midst of that. And then the claim is just say that they stole the body. Mm. That's what the alternative response they come up with. So there's a missing body no matter what.
But saying you lost a body, I mean, they stole the body. Doesn't that still mean they died though? Because
who died?
The guards.
Well, that's the religious leaders who are political leaders as well. Essentially bribe them and they protect them from them, right?
Well, just to push back, somebody also could say, well, couldn't the disciples have paid off the guards to steal the body?
Yeah, did they have the money is the question.
I don't know.
Where did they get the money from? Jesus is a very poor, by all accounts we have.
And his apostles were poor too?
Jesus is poor, yeah. They're all fishermen. Mm. You could say they're the equivalent of a small business owner. Okay. But on a day-to-day kind of, depending on how the fishing season was.
So they didn't have...
I mean, the guy that probably would have, might have possibly had some kind of money would have been Matthew, the tax collector, right?
Yeah.
To pay these guys off. But again, then you're looking at a risk-to-reward kind of thing. And again, I'm going to go back to saying, why steal a body and come up with a story like this?
You're right.
And then be willing to die for it?
No, yeah. And stealing the body doesn't even do... that much, depending on, like, because even stealing the body in itself is risky, right? Because if you steal the body, I don't know if you're gonna burn it, just put it under the sea, but there's the chance of that body or the remains of that body being found, and then
yeah,
so it's not a foolproof stealing the
even if you go and bury it somewhere, then you run the risk of one of your co-conspirators cracking.
Yeah,
right. And so if the disciples
died...
Well,
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, like, so what's his name wrote a really good book on this. Oh, man. He's called Nixon's Chuck Colson. So Chuck Colson was a part of the Watergate scandal and with the Nixon administration. And when they were all found out, he ended up going to jail and becoming a Christian, wrote a book on this stuff. And he actually does this comparison. He goes, it took us 2 weeks to crack. All the lies that they had come up with, they started investigating everybody individually and stuff. He said, in 2 weeks, we cracked. And people started telling on each other.
And they're probably back then, being that the Jewish people at that time who weren't Christians, there probably was an incentive to cracking. Like, if let's say they were lying, I would imagine, like, you could be paid for saying that, no, we did steal the body.
Yeah. Or you're tortured. You're just beaten a lot.
Yeah, and they were tortured.
Yeah, I mean, there's no laws against not being tortured like that. Unless you were a Roman citizen, which they weren't. Right? And then they were willing to travel to the ends of the earth. Like, literally, like, some of them went to India. Some of them went, and I'm not talking Paul, like, disciples.
Yeah.
Right? Some went to India, to Armenia, to Persia, to Egypt. Like, these guys went all away from each other. Like, one of them would have cracked. And they're all, like, horrendously treated and killed in various ways. There's some legends surrounding their deaths and stuff like that, but their deaths weren't walk in the parks. And you don't have any of them saying, no, man, like, we made this up. Because, again, remember I said the risk reward. Like, what are they gaining? Did they become richer?
No.
Did they have a lot of influence?
No.
No, they become more persecuted. Their families kick them out. Their society rejects them, both their Jewish society and the Roman society. Like, Christianity actually, you could say, becomes a thing post all of these guys dying.
Yeah, so it wasn't like they were even like local celebrities. Like,
they're not. Even locally, they're being beaten and
and they don't have like a follower. They don't have a lot of followers right now. Like, they're still, it's still very much so like a startup religion.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
I got you. So the incentive there just doesn't make sense to me. Steal the body again. If there is a better lie to tell, come up with a better lie. You might have gotten. Now there was a number of like weird spiritualist sects within Judaism. Like separatist movements, right? Like, so the most famous one of these separatist movements would have been what we call the Essenes, which rejected the temple, they rejected the Jewish religious structure, and they became separatists. They all lived amongst themselves. As a matter of fact, the Dead Sea Scrolls that we have that everybody speaks about is a result of the Essenes being separatists and copying this stuff down and then like hiding it in different places, right? But they're separatists. They're not a part of the main religious movement.
So wait, so just to pause. The Dead Sea Scrolls weren't the Bible? It was like a different book?
No, well, because they had scrolls back then. They didn't have books.
Well, there wasn't a Bible.
Yeah, they're copies of these scrolls that they stored in different places. Interesting. But they also, like, I think amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, they also found, like, shopping lists and stuff. Like, so it's like a bunch of stuff that was written that was kept.
Okay.
But again, like, the disciples could have come up with this weird story of Jesus resurrecting from the dead spiritually and then become separatists, and then whoever would listen to them would have become a part of their movement, and they would have been cool with it. Like, they would have become, their lives wouldn't have been on the line. They wouldn't have been saying, no, this stuff, like, you need to accept this or else you're going to hell. Like, it makes no sense. There's no serious incentive for them. But there's a number of other theories other than his body was stolen.
Okay.
Right? So let's name them, I think. One of them is that Jesus didn't really die. Like, so he's beaten. He's put on the cross. People assume he's dead. They think he's dead. And under that presumption, they take him and put him in a tomb thinking he's dead, but he's really not.
I didn't even think about
that. And then
he
shows, it's called a swoon theory. But cool, like, let's take it to its logical conclusion, right? Okay, Jesus is beaten, what is commonly called 40 lashes minus one, so 39 lashes. Okay, so anybody who's seen the Passion of the Christ, they're beating him with these whips that have, like, metal, and they have scraps of glass and stuff like that, like, at the ends of them. So it's meant to, like, cut into your flesh as they're beating you. It's not normal whipping. Mm-hmm. So that's the way they're beating Jesus.
Crazy.
They beat him enough where he's bleeding quite a bit. I should also add that the Romans had perfected the art and science of crucifixion. The Romans were crucifying. Like, it was like a mass production sort of thing. They regularly crucified. And they got really creative with it, by the way. Now, the crucifixion is not a Roman invention. It's an invention of the Carthaginians from North Africa. But the Romans perfected it. They knew how to kill people. Sometimes they just put people up on crosses to just embarrass them. They were already dead. So they'd kill people and then put them up on a cross. And they usually would put them, like, on the roads leading into a city as a sign and power of Rome. Just don't mess with Rome. And they'd put people up there naked.
Mm. Okay.
But so crucifixion generally kills you by you suffocate. Like, your lungs get filled with water. You can't breathe anymore. So you suffocate. And die.
Is that just due to, like, starvation?
It's the way you're hanging, and you can't take breath. You can't take a breath. So every time, if you're hanging on a cross, the way they've crucified you, in order for you to take a breath, you got to pull yourself up and breathe, and then you obviously have to drop yourself back down. So your lungs collapse, essentially.
So that means you die kind of quick.
No.
Really?
Yeah, you die. It's takes long time.
So you can breathe a little bit. You just can't, like,
breathe. Yeah, yeah. But they're
pulling yourself up and your hands on the nails?
Yeah. Oh. Well, they probably nailed you from here.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's what the research seems to suggest, it's here. And they would tie you, too, with ropes.
Okay.
But because it makes sense to nail you between these two bones, right?
Because I was always interested in, like, how you could get a nail in without breaking the bones. Because they said his bones didn't break, right?
Well, yeah, that's correct. You're right. But... So Jesus dies fairly, like, quickly. Okay. So the question is, why does Jesus die quickly? And again, here it goes back to these hints within the story that we need to pay attention to. So Jesus is hanging on the cross. There's two dudes around him. They're crucified as well. And there's a storm that comes about. And everybody's kind of panicking and trying to take off. And these soldiers go around breaking the ankles of the guys hanging on the cross. Why would you do that? So that they wouldn't be able to push themselves up and take a breath, so they'd hang fully and die. They get to Jesus, and one of the guys says he's dead. Right? And it could be that he's dead because of the beating he took. Most likely he's dead because of the beating he took. And he's like bled out and died. Or a combination of both of on the cross. So the other one tells, like, one of them takes a spear, and where does he stab him?
The side.
The side. And then the Bible says, water and blood came out. Well, why is it water and blood? Because his lungs have been filled with water. He's dead.
Oh.
So this is the medical, like, so someone who's a doctor who's reading this is immediately going to pay attention to that and go, yeah, dude, like, these guys have done enough crucifixions to know how to fact check whether someone's actually dead.
Also, that's why they stabbed him on the side.
Yeah. So they can make sure he's dead. Not to kill him.
I didn't really wonder, but it was like, did you really have to do that?
Yeah, it's like, it's very unnecessary.
It is unnecessary.
Like, dude, like,
okay, so it's like, okay,
overkill, right?
Right. He's already dead, or he's going to die.
Like. But they're really good at what they do. They're killing machines. Mm. And they're like, hey, we better make sure he's really dead. Mm. So they stab him in the side. And water and blood comes out, and it's like, oh, he is dead. So they don't break his ankles. It's unnecessary. He's dead. They take him down. But let's just say he's not dead, even at that point. He's got a stab wound to the side. He's been beaten and bled, like, for hours now. He's been crucified on a cross. They take him down. They put him in a cold, damp tomb. And they roll a 2-ton rock in front of it. Somehow, Jesus still bleeds there and is... Nobody's given him any medical aid. He's in the tomb. He's able to roll away a 2-ton rock, come out and present himself to these Roman soldiers that he's back from the dead in a semi-dead state, show up to the disciples, and he's like, I'm resurrected in glory. And they're like, yes, and not like, dude, get him a doctor. And convince them that that's what's happened, and then somehow disappear off the face of the earth so that the disciples run around teaching. Like, is that a reasonable theory?
And then not to mention the fact that, like, if he did live, then he has to be, like, in Hitler hiding, like...
Correct.
To never be found again, he's still alive.
Yeah.
And nobody... okay.
So, like, he's not, like, not aging or something. Like, or let's just say he, like, takes off and lives in obscurity somewhere as... Like, what does he gain out of it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody knows that, like... The scheme worked. Like, it's sort of like there's a joke about a pastor who skips church on a Sunday. He like fakes being sick, and he goes golfing, and God's kind of looking at this guy, and they're playing golf, and the guy takes a whack, hole in one, and then the angels come to God and they're like, hey, why'd you allow for that to happen? And God says, well, he can't tell anyone. He can't celebrate his hole in one. He lied about it. Right? It's sort of that. Like, who are you going to tell? Like, hey, man, I this scheme. I know this religion that's being like, but it was all my scheme, but that's still alive. Like, on your deathbed. Like, you can't. It just doesn't work. Yeah. So that's the, like, he really wasn't. There's a theory that Jesus had a secret twin. So Jesus got a twin brother. The idea in this is that...
They killed his twin, but he still lived.
But there's two theories that function around this, okay? One of them is that they kill Jesus.
Oh, and
but
his twin
is, like, takes his place. Mm. I'm like, cool, let's take that to this logical thing. We know for sure Jude and James are Jesus' brothers, right?
Yeah.
There's half brothers. Like, would these guys not know he had a twin brother? Like, how about Jesus' mom?
Or anybody, like, who's cool with him at all.
Yeah, like, anyone that's hung out with him and spent time with him. And the interesting thing is, in the Gospels, here's one of those things. Jesus goes and preaches in his hometown, and the people's reaction is this not Joseph's son, the carpenter's son? Like, are his sisters not married to our sons? Are his brothers not this person and that person?
Yeah. So he couldn't even...
Yeah, like, dude, this is a small town boy.
Yeah.
He's a small village boy. I don't know. Maybe this is hard for Americans, like, in big cities to figure out. But most of the world lives in small towns. And when something happens, everybody knows about it. Like, when you mess up, everybody knows you messed up. And not only is it like Arthur messed up, but it's like Arthur, the son of so-and-so, the brother of such-and-such, really messed up. That guy's an untrustworthy character. Don't trust, right? Like, your whole entire family's name is now on the line. So you got to be very careful. Reputation matters quite a bit. Currently in the world, but also in the ancient world even more.
I can imagine.
And they literally have these sorts of reactions to Jesus. Are these not his sisters? Is this not his mom and dad? Are these not his brothers? Jesus' brothers don't believe him in the beginning. They have a hard time. They're like, go prove yourself. He's like, no, it's not my time. James's conversion to actually following Jesus is actually one of the evidences that Dr. Habermas uses, that he's a reluctant convert. That he would have had more reason.
Outside of the Bible stories?
So, no, I mean, James is the author of the letter of James.
Oh.
That's the James. There's a couple of Jameses in the Bible.
Yeah, and that James is Jesus' brother.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So it's Jude. Yeah.
Jude's brother too?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
And so, like, why would these guys believe? Like, these are people who would have known about this stuff pretty clearly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or again, even if it's the same argument, if it's his brother that's killed, right? This sometimes takes a weird variation of it's like, it wasn't Jesus on the cross that was killed. This is the weird Islamic explanation of it. So Muslims don't think Jesus died.
Oh, they think he's...
He just ascended. And then, so the idea is that, like, God made it seem like it was Jesus on the cross, but it wasn't Jesus. And then depending on the different people you talk to, some of them will say it was Judas, made to look like Jesus. Some of them say it was just like a kind of mirage of sorts. It was a facade. It was like, yeah. It wasn't really Jesus. That brings into question a bunch of different things about God's character. But like killing innocent people for something they haven't done like is something that they're trying to get away from. But... like, this guy really didn't do anything.
Yeah.
That's why some of them will say it was Judas, because he betrayed him, so he deserved it. Yeah. But it's like, did anybody, like, who comes up with this story? It's like, oh, Muhammad comes up with it 600 years later.
Yeah.
Should we trust him, or should we trust the guys that hung out with Jesus?
Right.
I take my bets with that guy, right?
Yeah.
Wrong tomb theory. So the disciples showed up at the wrong tomb on Sunday morning. And they were like, oh, it's empty. He must have risen from the dead. That's one of the theories. And I would just say, again, a very simple way of knowing this was, it only would work if you didn't know whose tomb it was. But you know it's Joseph's tomb. And Joseph could have been like, no, guys, like, wrong tomb. It's this one.
And he's still in here.
Yeah.
And he's right here.
It still doesn't answer the questions of Jesus' appearances to his disciples. And for them to be convinced of that. Because there's later appearances. There's people like Thomas who don't believe. Right? It's like, Thomas is like, I want to see, man. And Jesus shows up. It's like, how did that happen? So, the wrong tomb theory doesn't seem like it has much going for it. And so again, like for me, like anytime somebody comes up with any kind of a theory, and we can have various theories or variations of them, my immediate reaction is, cool, let's assume it's true and run it to its logical conclusion.
Yeah.
And then see if it makes sense. See if the disciples would have had reason to do whatever it is. Like anything else you would investigate. Like think about like all the conspiracy theories we hear today.
Yeah.
There's tons of them, man. You make content. Yeah. I make content. Yeah. And we hear some crazy stuff.
Of course.
From the moon landing was fake.
Yep.
To, I don't know, the recent disease that was in the world was somehow cool. Let's assume it's true. And then let's run it down. Let's run it down and see if it makes sense. Like, for example, the moon landing story. I don't have a stake in this game. I really don't care. But I would just say, how many people would it take to come up with a conspiracy of that sort? Right? Not only initially, but also after the fact of people who are sending things into space. How many people does it take to maintain that? It's quite a bit of people. Or the flat earth kind of stuff that regularly comes about. Like, can you imagine the amount of people you'd have to convince? You can't say NASA. NASA's not a person.
Right.
Where it's like three friends sitting together like, hey, bro, you want to do this?
And knowledge that's learned from, like, that research, I mean, that landing on the moon is then applied to so many other.
Yeah.
So if that were not true, then so many things that,
yeah. And sending satellites into space and the people involved in that and people actually going and looking like so it's a lot of stuff. Is it possible? Sure, in a really weird way. But again, I dabble in philosophy. When you tell me something is possible or not, a lot of things could be possible, dude. Like we could be, you know, brains in a vat. Like that's possible. But is it probable? Like, does the evidence suggest that?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to be the case. So what does the evidence suggest? And I would just, ultimately, I kind of circle around and come to the people asking these questions, and I say, the reason why it seems to me that you don't want to believe in the resurrection is not because there's a lack of evidence or rationality or intelligence in the conversation. It's more that your presumption is that God doesn't exist. Mm. But let's just for 10 minutes assume God existed. Would God be able to do the sort of stuff that we're talking about, like bring someone back from the dead? Well, if God created the universe and everything in it, if there was nothing and then there was something, and the beauty and the intelligence that we see, whether it's just generally in creation, the mechanism of it in ourselves and everything that works so well together to be finely tuned for us to have the sort of life that we get to have. Mm-hmm. If God has the ability to do that, if God has the ability to create something from nothing, do you really think it's beyond God's ability to bring someone back from the dead? That seems pretty rational to me.
Yeah.
And so then I would say maybe there's a presumption there or a presupposition that you just don't want to think that there is a God. And maybe there is. And then maybe you can have a conversation with someone about, like, is there any arguments for God's existence? There's plenty of arguments for God's existence, right? Whether you come at it from a scientific lens, whether you come at it from a philosophical sense. I think the arguments are, not all arguments are good arguments, right? Like, there's arguments I think are good. There's arguments I think are like, I can see them being good or bad.
Yeah.
And then there's arguments that I think are just bad.
Yeah.
Right? And like, I don't stop being a Christian for me to hear an argument about God's existence from another Christian and be like, that's a bad argument, man. Like, don't say that to anyone, please. Yeah. and then some of them being good.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's like, well, I got two or three or a combination of two or three arguments that I think work really well together to give me evidence to think that there's a God. And so it really comes down to this. Mm. Am I reasonable and rational to believe that there's a God? Yeah, because I'm making my decisions on rational and reasonable evidences, arguments, as I am with anything else, right? And when I'm looking at the resurrection, I'm basing it on the way we do history. Julius Caesar went and did X thing. Cool, how do we know about it? Well, it's in his writings. He said he did it. Is that enough reason for me to just reject he did it? Doesn't seem like it. Like, I can't just go, no, he's writing it himself. Must be lying. No, maybe he's right about it. Alexander the Great is a really good example of this. I think the earliest documents we have about Alexander's conquest is like 200-300 years after he lived.
And I like how you keep referencing other history points, because basically what you're saying is the same way that the other history that we've studied has been developed and been gotten to a point where we learned it in history class is the same way that the Bible kind of like got to the point of being able to tell us about how these things came about. Yeah. So like that's I see where you're going. I see where you're going. So
the thing is that like people get hung up on the miracle stuff. Like the miracle stuff for me is an afterthought. Okay, like apart from the resurrection. Like the resurrection is a miracle. But notice the way I approach the resurrection is when you have all these things happening, what's the rational conclusion?
So then question though. So then did Jesus, when he did like when he was raised from the dead, did he then only show himself to a small select group of people? How many people in history seen Jesus alive after he was?
That's very interesting, right? Like this would be a part of that whole conversation about, like you're coming up with a conspiracy. Let's keep it as small as possible.
But isn't that what it was, or no?
But well, let's just see if it was or not. Like, what does the data show in regards to the saying? So, say the disciples were, you know, Judas is gone, and then they're like, hey, the 11 of us, pretty good group. We can maintain this, but it doesn't seem like it. In the book of Acts, there's a lot more than 11 in the upper room, right?
Okay.
And now, at that point, I think they replaced Judas with Matthias. And there's 12 of them are speaking in tongues, proclaiming the gospel of God, that this Jesus you guys have killed has come back to life. So there's 12, let's just say, plus these other folks that are committed to this guy Paul is a very unique individual. There's a number of things about him that are very unique. Number one, he's not a follower of Jesus from the beginning, but he's also not a neutral guy. He's not a guy that's like, I'm not on this side or I'm not that on side. Paul is a persecutor of the church. Mm-hmm. Now his name is Saul, that's his Hebrew name, and it seems like there's a Romanized or Greco version of his name, which is Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And so Saul is a young man when one of Jesus's followers, Stephen, is being killed. And in that interaction, it's very interesting because the book of Acts introduces Saul in the context of Stephen's death. So it says they gathered stones, they're stoning Stephen. Stephen prays the same exact prayer Jesus prays on the cross. Father, forgive them for they don't know what they do. Which is very interesting. He also makes another proclamation that's theologically significant, where he says, "Jesus is. I see the heavens open up, and Jesus is standing at the right hand of the Father, which is the place of power, right hand. But he's also standing, which is judgment language, and not sitting, which is like Jesus. Essentially, he's saying, I see Jesus going to judge you guys for what you're doing to me. But it still prays for their salvation. And then it says, the people that are casting the stones take off their coats and they bring it and they give it to Saul to like hold or at its feet or something. And that's a sign of respect for this young man who is by this point a religious scholar by his own right. And then it introduces us to Saul saying he's so zealous for his religion that he's willing to go and find followers of Jesus and either imprison them or kill them. So this is not a guy. This is a guy who really doesn't want this story to get out.
Of course.
Because he sees it as a blasphemous religious movement because they're claiming that their human leader is God incarnate.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the midst of that, he has a vision or an experience. It seems like it's a vision. He hears things that other people aren't hearing. He sees things that other people aren't seeing. But that's common within the Old Testament story.
Yeah.
Right? And then he has a conversion. He's like, okay, I'm going to go around and tell people about this Jesus too. Now, this guy in the book of Corinthians, in the letter of Corinthians, says, after the resurrection of Jesus, Jesus first appeared to his disciples, his immediate disciples. And then he says, and also appeared to me as the one born out of time. Jesus appeared to him at a different time. And then, but when he says to the 12 disciples, he also says, he also appeared to 500 other people. And he makes this statement, some of whom who've fallen asleep. That's a euphemism for death.
Okay.
Some of whom who've died, but some are alive. Which again, remember I said when you're studying these, it's these things. It's like, cool, he's appealing to evidence. He's saying, guys, some of the people who saw Jesus after resurrection are still alive. You can go find them and talk to them. But you don't believe me? Go ask around. Again, small towns, small cities, small countries. Word spreads like crazy. Remember when Jesus is doing his ministry, he's preaching, and then large groups start gathering. How did the large groups start gathering? They're not sending out mass emails. There's no news that's saying, you know, Jesus is going to make an appearance on the mount.
Yeah.
Like, people just told people, like, oh man, I heard this guy. And people, word spreads.
So then, question, and this is just, so when I'm reading the Bible and I hear about, like, when the Gospels start talking about Jesus' resurrection, you have the ladies, forgive me for not remembering their names, who come to the tomb.
They're the ladies. By the way, that's a weird thing. People talk about that. Why the ladies?
Interesting. But then when he, like, shows himself to them, from my recollection, I think he says, all right, go let them know I'm here.
Yeah.
So then where did he go? Did he just, like... Like, how did he get from, because did he walk, did he just, yeah. why didn't they just walk together? Did he, like, disappear and then reappear?
So it seems like Jesus is not, we're going into.
Sorry, I know I'm sidetracking this a little bit, but it's a
different kind of conversation. It seems like Jesus' post-resurrection body is able to do things that our natural bodies can't do.
Okay.
Which is, like, space and time don't seem to have a hold on him. Physical objects don't seem to restrain him. So... It, again, those hints in the stories. It says the disciples are gathered in the upper room and the door is closed. And it says Jesus appeared among them and said, peace to you.
Mm.
And so this is when Thomas is saying, I won't believe till I see him. So the door is closed.
And I thought they opened the door for him.
He like walks through objects.
Oh, wow.
So now I had this question when I was in Bible college. And it was kind of bugging me. I was like, dude, like, how's his body doing this stuff? So I went to one of my really brilliant professors, and I thought this is like a knockdown question, by the way, at the time. I was like, dude, this is a good question. He's not going to have an answer. So I go up to him. I was like, professor, like, that X, Y, and Z. And then he looked at me, and he said, Arthur, can you do the stuff? He said, were you able to do stuff that you do today when you were like 2 years old? And I was like, well, no. Like, there was a time I couldn't walk. And there was a time I couldn't talk, and there was a time I couldn't do X, Y, and Z. And he said, okay, so why is it so hard for you to picture our bodies that are post-death bodies doing stuff that we can't do now?
Right.
And I was like, dude, that was a really good answer. I was like, man, it seemed to me like you've heard this question before. And he was like, yeah, I think I sort of have. But again, that's a rational answer.
Yeah.
That why can't we look, if you're assuming post-death existence, by the way.
Of course.
Someone has to assume that for this conversation to carry on.
Yeah.
But if somebody assumes post-death existence, then it's just a part of our growth process where we have the ability to do things that we can't do naturally now.
Mm.
And that makes sense to me.
Okay. Okay.
He's moving in weird kind of spatial dimensions.
So then if you didn't get a chance to see Jesus, you really just kind of have to take the word of those who said they did.
Yeah.
Essentially. Though.
Correct.
And then, but I would imagine, like, there's within those, like, people, probably people who probably wouldn't just say that. Like you have those friends who, like, they're not going to just say
take your word?
Yeah, like, you know what I mean? So I would imagine... if there is, let's say, 500 people out of the 500, somebody's like, yeah, no, it really did happen. And it's like, oh, if he's saying that.
Yeah, I trust this guy.
Like, it must have really happened.
I don't know about those guys.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't know about those guys. But if he's saying it, it must have really happened.
Yeah.
So, okay. All right. So then I guess, like, history-wise, that
But let's just look at, like, personal testimony, because that's important. A lot of, okay. Some people would go, like, why trust them?
Yeah.
I'm like, cool. You've just completely said we shouldn't trust anything historically written. Until the last 150 years since we had pictures or videos. But even think about it now.
Yeah.
Like, what about all the, like, deep fakes that are coming out, AI stuff? Where it's like, can we trust testimony at all? So in a court of law, the best kind of evidence, and you go and look up, you can watch interviews with J. Warner Wallace, and he'll say this. Eyewitness testimony is better than DNA evidence.
DNA evidence?
Yeah. Because DNA evidence tells you, like, a fact.
Yeah.
Like, we found this guy's DNA there.
Right.
It doesn't tell you how it got there.
But you know he was there.
Yeah. Like, it could have been, like, he was there, like, 8 days before the murder actually happened.
Oh.
And, like, hair fall off of him. But eyewitness testimony is the best evidence. Multiple eyewitness testimony.
Okay, see, now I'm with you.
Now here's the thing. Multiple eyewitness testimony is even better evidence.
Yeah.
Now, if you have one person saying, hey, I saw the guy 11:59 exiting the house. And then, you know, they do their research. They're like, the victim died at 11:48. It's like, oh, that puts him in really close proximity to when this event happened. So, cool. What was he wearing? Oh, he was wearing this and he was wearing that. And then you do your research. You go and check out the guy's house. He has the same clothing. Is he being framed? Maybe. Maybe this is a hater. Like, we don't know, right? Like, so, but imagine if you had, like, four people that saw him and one of them was, oh, I saw him enter the house, but I never saw him exit, but I saw him enter the house at 10 p.m. Now you've placed him at 10 p.m. and then you've placed him at 11:59 and the murder took place in between that. You got some stuff going for you.
100%.
So again, this is a lot of the work of J. Warner Wallace, where he's like, this is just the way we crack cases, man. It's eyewitness testimony. Someone said this, someone said that. We found this. Oh, we went and looked at the guy's bathtub and it was bleached recently. Within the last, like, 2 hours after the murder, the timing we have of the murder. So they build these cases. And then we make decisions to send people to prison for life or give them the death penalty based on eyewitness testimony. So in a court of law, you are supposed to prove, as the prosecution, beyond a reasonable doubt, not certainty. Your arguments have to be beyond reasonable doubt. Mm. If you meet that criteria and the jury is convinced beyond reasonable doubt, then they find the person guilty. Mm. And that's all I think we're asking people to do as Christians. Like, I'm not asking for certainty, right? Like, in the philosophical sense of certainty, like 100% kind of certainty.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just asking people to look at the evidence and ask themselves whether they are convinced of this beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm.
Now, people can have religious experiences. Cool. Like, religious experiences for me are maybe like a step below eyewitness testimony. Because when you have multiple people saying this happened, the other thing J. Warner Wallace says is, he said if we show up to, like, a scene and we have multiple eyewitness folks who claim that they saw this, and we separate them, he says the first thing we do is separate them. Never want them together. You find out these people say they saw this, you don't allow them to talk to each other. Because that can contaminate stuff. It can actually mess with their memory.
Mm.
Okay? So this is crazy. So he goes, we separate them, and then we ask them. He says, if they have almost the same exact story with the same exact details, they're suspect. Like, they got together and made this story up. It's too good to be true that they all are explaining the events the same way. He says, you never expect eyewitness testimony to tell you the story the same exact way.
Because people don't notice different things.
Yeah, exactly. People are paying attention to different stuff. Like, the doctor who saw the accident is going to notice something. The doctor might notice, like, the heavy breathing of the person that's dying. where the police officer might notice something else. Yeah. And your average, like Joe, might just notice the accident itself, right?
Yeah.
So here's what, again, I'm just quoting this guy.
Right? Yeah.
He says when we read the Gospels, we see exactly what we expect as detectives. They have intricacies and they don't align perfectly. And he goes, we don't expect them to align perfectly if they're right. They're going to have differences because John is seeing things differently and his attention is on different stuff. And Mark, which seems to be dictated by Peter, is seeing things differently. And Luke, who's doing his interviewing people, it seems like, his compiling information, is gathering different sorts of stuff, right? And Matthew's doing it. And he goes, you put it together. And you go, yeah, we see all the differences.
Mm.
So one of the Gospels, Jesus shows up at the Gerasenes, I think, right? Like, so there's a demoniac there, the guy who has a legion of demons. And one of the Gospels says, this guy comes rushing. Jesus is casting out the demon. He says, get out. And then he says, how many are you? He says, legion. The guy cuts himself. He lives in the graveyard. They have him chained up. The other Gospel says there's two guys in the cemetery. There's not one demoniac. There's two. And then people go, well, this is an inconsistency in the Gospels. Why does one say there's one and the other says, because one author is focusing on one thing, which is typically how we do things. Like, you know, you walk into a room, there's 15 people there. You go up to the guy you know best. You have a conversation with him. After the party, I come to him and I go, hey, what was he wearing? Like, oh, he was wearing a blue shirt. I go, but what was so-and-so wearing? They're like, dude, I don't know. No idea.
Yeah.
I don't remember what he was wearing because you didn't pay attention to that. But imagine you had like hyper attention disorder or something. You like walk in there, you're like, and afterwards you're like, this guy was wearing this, that guy was wearing that, that guy's shoes were dirty, that guy's this. You're a different sort of person. You're gonna tell me information differently.
Yeah.
And I just expect people's testimonies to look like this.
Mm. And I can see that. I can see that.
It's rational. It's very reasonable. It's the way we operate. And sometimes people sit there and they're like, no, I'm still going to be skeptical. It's like, but you don't live your life like that.
You know, what's interesting. I think like when I think about like now that you've explained to me how history works, when I think about just like the way history is taught to us, like it almost feels like when you learn about Martin Luther King, when you learn about the Egyptian history,
yeah,
like whatever it's taught in, like, you know, in, like just in high school and in elementary, it feels like the law almost like confirms this history. Like it feels just so certified.
Yeah.
But when I think about how it got to that point of being taught in schools, it got there by in a similar fashion as the Bible, yeah, got put together. But it doesn't feel that way when it's taught. And now, when I don't know, like I think my perspective of just like how the Bible, like, I think what you're saying really puts respect, a lot more respect on the Bible in itself. You know,
yeah. So,
I mean?
This is called like common sense.
Yeah.
So there's an aspect of philosophy that's called common sense philosophy, and I view this as there's different apologetic methodologies. This is called a cumulative case approach.
Mm.
What I'm doing, I'm just putting it all together, right? And I agree with you. You brought up Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
Here's a guy that is very important to the history of the United States. What do we know about him, right? We know he was assassinated. And we like, who was there to see his assassination? So am I going to trust the people that were present? Or am I going to trust, say, somebody sitting in an office somewhere that's like keeping tabs on him? Now, information can come up about someone, right? Like, we know that he was being, like, followed by the FBI. And maybe there's some information they have that other people don't have. That's fine. Bring it into there. We see, is it rational? Like, does it fill in some gaps in his life that otherwise wasn't filled in? But let's just say the question is, what was his favorite breakfast? Who am I going to trust on that, man? Am I going to trust his wife? Am I going to trust his kids? Or am I going to trust some historian let's just say, that is like studying him, who isn't relying on information from his wife and his kids. Like, it would be really irrational for some guy to come and say, I have a PhD and I've studied Martin Luther King Jr. Great. Please tell me what his favorite breakfast was. And he goes, well, you know, we've decided in this endeavor to be objective, not to talk to people who had a bias about him. And so we didn't include his daughter and his wife in this study. And I'm looking at him, I'm like, why not? Like, wouldn't those be the people that would have seen him on a daily basis? Yeah. Well, we asked this guy who traveled with him. We asked this other guy. But like, who made him breakfast more? His wife. It's like, assuming a number of things, right?
Yeah.
And it, like, that's the way I view like some people that approach Jesus and theology. They're like, we've decided to study Jesus without looking at the guys who hung out with him and wrote stuff about him. And I'm like, why? Let's just say they were wrong. That's okay. I'm even willing and to grant they could have been wrong. But why are you not including the people that would have spent the most time with him?
What conclusion do they come to when they, let's say, exclude?
Well, the thing is that they always come to weird conclusions about him.
Mm.
They always come to conclusions like, the stuff that the disciples were teaching was different. The message that Jesus was preaching was different than the one that these people are saying. This has way too many religious motifs. They kind of try to secularize him. It's like you will have people write professional academic journals and books on mythologizing Jesus, de-religizing Jesus. And it's like, why? He literally lives in a very religious time period, very religious society, and his students came up with the religion.
Yeah.
So why are you trying to do that? You're trying to make him a lot like us? Secular, the way we view the world? How does that make any sense? So that's like my thing is, most of the historical stuff we know that we trust, like you were saying, was from people who spent time with whomever, whether that's Thomas Jefferson, whether that's George Washington or the founders of this country, or whoever it may be.
It's almost like arrogant ignorance. But at the same time, it's like, how do you get somebody to like not feel that way? Because it's so natural to feel like that initial thought that feels so smart is a smart thought.
Yeah,
like there's no way that happened. And like, because most, your average person is not going to even get to a point of like looking into all this. They're just gonna jump to a conclusion. Like, how, yeah, you know what I mean?
So, but I would just say your average person is not an atheist.
Yeah.
Like, let's look at the world.
Yeah.
How many percent of the world is an atheist? How many people in the world have a predominantly from the get-go religious outlook on life?
Yeah.
And so, if I'm just going to go by numbers, I just be like, I'm going to ignore you guys. Like, the way you think is out of the norm. This, like, unless you're going to view yourself as like a more advanced version of our species than somebody who prays to their ancestors in China, right? Or people in Africa who have religious traditions and ceremonies and songs they do,
mm-hmm,
and Christians who pray to God by the power of the Holy Spirit. Like any religion you look at that point, most people are religious.
So then, question. So then, so when looking at just kind of how everybody's kind of processing all of this right now, how do you get somebody to see what, like, just to value this? Because if you don't, most people, I would assume, would look at being a believer in Christ or look at being a Christian or whatever and kind of say, maybe they're right. If I did the research, maybe they're wrong. But when I look at you, I kind of see somebody just like me. I don't even understand what makes your life so much more different than everybody else. You know what I mean? Like, you know, people throw this out all the time. Like, you know, I think religions make you a better person.
Yeah.
But I don't think that they are real, and I can't trust it enough to lock in on it, right? What would you, so like, what's the whole point? What, like, how would you answer that? Like, what, like, if somebody were to ask you, what's so special about you now that you're a Christian, or like, what makes it so important?
Yeah.
Why are you even fighting for me to even know this information? What would you say?
Yeah. Let me define the purpose of apologetics.
Okay.
Okay. It's simple. There's two things apologetics does.
Mm-hmm.
One is that it reassures and gives good reasons for somebody to know what and why they believe it, Christianity to be true. So it is for the building up of the Christian person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other one is that I think it gets rid of weeds and barriers for people who don't want to believe, who are skeptics. It's not going to fully convince people, because ultimately people need to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets rid of barriers. It's like, oh man, I thought this thing was really smart and a really good argument.
Yes.
And then I read this book or had this conversation, and it's not that good anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm closer to believing it.
Yes.
And if I can sit down and have a conversation with someone and take them from point A to point B, I don't always expect to take someone from point A to point Z.
Mm-hmm.
That's lifelong work, man. That's a of lot course. Of different stuff goes into that.
Yes.
But I go, hey, what's the best thing you have against Christianity? And they're like, this.
Well,
like, cool, let's talk about it. And if at the end of it they're like, man, that puts some serious doubt in that thing, I'm like, cool, I'm good. Yeah. A good conversation, walk away.
Of course.
Now, why does it matter?
Yeah.
Because if I'm right, the person in front of me is gonna spend eternity separated from God.
Mm.
Not in the joy and happiness and grace and the beauty of God.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm right.
Okay.
If I'm wrong, not much changes.
Okay.
Okay. Unless some other religion is right, but then we can speak about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one.
Okay.
I don't immediately go to like, it's going to make you a better person. I'm not very sure about that. You might already be a really good person to start off with, but that doesn't mean you're good enough to go into the glory of God.
Right.
Right?
Like, it's not based on goodness.
Yeah, it's on God's grace. You might already be like a pretty decent individual. Like, your life is set up pretty good.
Yeah.
You're pretty wealthy. You're an entrepreneur. You're a great father or a wife, a mother. Like, you care for your love. Like, generally, you like live by a Christian ethic, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
What we would consider like a good person.
Yeah.
Still say you need Jesus. Because you were created by God with the intent of having a relationship with God. Humanity was. We were never intended to live life apart from God. We were never created to live separate from the source of all existence, from the source of all goodness, beauty, and truth.
Mm.
So it's like returning to that. What I would say is like returning back to the garden for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point is, for you to be reunited with God. Now, there's an added caveat to that, is that you get to spend eternity with God as well. And so I will just reflect maybe on, like, why should I care about that? I would say, we tell people because we love people. So this is, Augustine said this in the 4th century. We tell people about the gospel because we love people. We want them to know the truth. I would add on to that is, it's a better thing for you to know things, for you to know the most amount of true things rather than live your life falsely. So if Christianity is true, I want you to know that.
Mm.
As I want you to know whatever else is true, right? If you were under the assumption that, this is funny, because I got little kids and they do funny stuff. So, you know, I'll mess around with my kids sometimes. And I'll give him like a dollar, and I'm like, here's $100. And my youngest son, who's 5, and when he was younger, he'd like run around the house and be like, I got $100 in my hand, right? I get all really happy. Now, if he does that, my oldest son will be like, what? Like, let me see it. And he'll look at it and be like, Wagen, this is not $100, man. Like, you've been duped. This is a dollar. Right? And why? Well, there's the added bonus of like, not having 100, like being $99 in the negative.
Right.
But he also just wants him to know the truth. Why is he telling him that? Because he wants his brother to know the truth so that he does not lie to, So he's not duped. Like, if you're under the assumption that 2 + 2 = 2, and you keep going to the market, and people keep cheating you or whatever like that, like, it just makes no sense. You would want people to know truth. A part of the human endeavor, and this is true, there we go, right? Across the board, is a pursuit of truth.
Yeah.
And I want to, apart from like loving God and my family and being good to those around me, like I want to die knowing more true things than I know now. Like I'd be satisfied. This partly takes me back to what the Greek philosophers gave us. Mm. And the Greek philosophers, one of their major contributions to world history is this classical understanding of loving that. And it's unique that they use this word love because we don't speak like this. Loving that which is true, good, and beautiful. Mm. And they said this is the pursuit of life. They actually said this is like the point of existence. The purpose, they used a word for it that meant like design. The telos, the purpose of life. And it's unique that they put beauty in there. Like loving that which is beautiful. And like loving good music and enjoying good music is being fulfilled. You're like fulfilling what you were created for. Mm. And truth, like the endeavor to know true things, is a part of this. Mm. It's as important as being good, virtuous.
Yeah.
As loving beautiful things, good art, good music, good food, good friends.
And how would you say, and granted, I'm speaking from a very what does this do for me perspective, but I think that's how people, for whatever reason, look at life. How does the knowledge of true things improve one's life?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, again, I would go back to the purpose that the Greek philosopher said this, was that so you are a better citizen. And they meant this like politically. Mm. And I mean it politically, but I'll add some more to it. So I'm just a generally better human. Now, again, somebody might say, well, you were already a good human before you became a Christian. I'm like, yeah, but I'm better now. Mm. Right? So that I'm a better friend, so that I'm a better husband, so that I'm a better father. Right. So, practical example. If I lose my cool on my kids and I yell at them unnecessarily, like, which father hasn't done this?
Of course.
Right? What's my response? So I sit back. Say I get angry and I yell at them unnecessarily, right? Like, the reaction was not equal to whatever it was that they did to get that out of me. I was having a bad day. I'm stressed out. I come from work. They do something. I just yell at them and kind of lose my cool.
Yeah.
At times, I'll go back and sit in my chair and then go, man, like, they didn't deserve that. But what do I do then? Because they're kids. The oldest kid I have is 9. I can just let it go. They can't do anything to me. They're kids. What's the best they're going to do? Maybe they'll grow up and not like me very much, but they might actually grow up and they'll like never remember that event at all. But I have a responsibility before God of being a good father. Yeah. First and foremost, that's where it starts in my mind. The question I ask myself is, and sort of prayerfully, I say, God, how am I honoring you as a father? Yeah. Like, what should I do in this situation? And I look at the Bible, I think about God's thought, and I go, man, I got to repent. I got to apologize. So I go and I pull my kids aside and I collect them together. And I say, listen, guys, I want to apologize to you guys for the way I acted. Mm. And I want you guys and I need you guys to forgive me for the way I acted. And I don't just let it go. Like, I'll sit there and be like, I need you guys to like say, I forgive you. Mm. And then they'll be like, Dad, we forgive you, or I forgive you. And I'm like, cool, thank you.
What I love about that is because you could, in theory, you could maybe get to that conclusion outside of being a Christian, correct, right?
Yes.
But what I love about what you're explaining is the chance of you running into that conclusion as a Christian is a lot higher, or maybe learning that lesson faster, right? Like, and when even non-Christians look at the life of Jesus, they all have to kind of acknowledge, like, man, I don't think you could live a more, like, selfless, like, loving life. Like yeah. That's, like, love just as, in its purest way, right? So I love what you're saying. Like, I've asked this question many times, and I think your answer kind of resonates with, like, how I feel the most. Like, I really respect what you're saying.
And yeah, because, look, too many Christians are, like, they're just concerned about death and heaven.
Yeah.
That, to me, is an afterthought. It's sort of like, it would be weird if I sat there and I thought about what it would be like for Arthur to be 75.
Yeah.
Now, if I make it there, then I'll get there. I don't have to, like, be in a rush to get there.
Yeah.
Like, what's the point? If I'm guaranteed as a Christian, right, like, God's been gracious to me, he's forgiven me, I'm going to enjoy eternity with him forever. That's an afterthought. I'm like, I'm going to get that. It's already there. It's in the bank. We're cool. It's like, how do I live today? Now, Jesus spoke like this. Jesus said, don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow has enough worries of itself. Right? Like, think about today. And the context he's saying that is, give your worries and your anxieties to God today. Like, don't worry. Don't. That's going to... He doesn't say there aren't going to be any worries tomorrow. He says, tomorrow will have enough worries of itself. Mm. Right? It's guaranteed. That's a part of life. That's a part of existence. Right? So if that's already there, like, eternity is already there for me, then the question I ask is, what's the point of my life? Like, why didn't I become a Christian and God said, hey, Art, you're good, dead, heaven? So what is it that God might be doing to me in this life that might not be the case in eternity? One of them, and the one that I come to as an individual person, is the Bible speaks about this thing called sanctification, which is, very simply put, being made to be like Jesus more and more. Now, every Christian is saved, is the language we use, or theologically we said justified. But every Christian is also sanctified, or being sanctified. The word there is saint, that's in there, being made like a saint. And the idea is being changed into the image of the Son of God, to be changed to become like Jesus. So the Bible says in the book of Romans, do not be conformed to the patterns of this world, to the way the world does things, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. The word for transformed there is in the passive. It's in the passive, and it's in the way it's written, the word itself is, it's in second person passive, I think, that this is something someone else is doing to you. They're transforming you. So the idea there is that don't be conformed to the patterns of the world. So that's a responsibility you do. You're not becoming like the world. And then in doing that, God is transforming you and your mind. And then it tells you a reason. So that, it says, you would test and approve what the perfect will of God is. So these things are happening so that we know what the will of God is. And the Christian life is a life of continuous transformation and change so that I become more like Jesus. Yes. So that any Christian becomes more like Jesus. And look, some of us are knuckleheads and it's going to take us a long time. And some people, it's going to take a less time. And I don't know, maybe this is somehow related to the timing of our deaths. That would be like pure conjecture and guess on my part. Maybe like Arthur needs 30 years to become more like Jesus.
Oh.
And maybe someone else needs 20, and that's when they're going to die. And that's when Arthur, I have no idea.
Okay.
That's a complete guess. So I can be wrong in all sorts of ways.
I see where you're going.
But like, and so I view life from that perspective. And I think that's scriptural because you become a Christian and you go, now what? Well, now you learn what it looks like to be like Jesus. And we do that in multiple ways. We do that by prayer. We do that by studying and reading the Bible, God's revelation. Like, I learn more about God and I go, oh man, like, God's like that and I'm not like that. And how can I be like that? It's like, oh, I can do this, this, and this. Some of it has to do with being in a church community. So one of my influences is a guy named Dallas Willard, who's passed on now, but he was a professor of philosophy at USC. Head of the department, Christian, Jesus-loving dude. Like, the guy was a really good philosopher, really good theologian. And he goes, what's the point of the church? And he says, well, it's like a group of Christians who come together and they're like, hey, we want to be more like Jesus. let's spend like 6 weeks learning what that looks like together in community. And let's learn what it's like to love people and to be loved by people, because that's hard. Mm. It's really hard. This is why marriage is hard. Because the person that is closest to you, that you give the most reason not to love you, chooses to love you every day. Mm. Like you wake up and she's like, yeah, man, you stink, like physically, right?
Yeah.
And you do stupid stuff, but I'm going to love you today.
Yeah.
And you do the same to them.
Yeah.
And so you learn what that's like. That's why you see people who've been married for like 40 years. They can like read each other's minds if it's a healthy marriage.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, how is that possible? Because they found the secret of what it's like to allow someone to love them. Mm. And then for them to love that person. And here's a good definition of love. It's the best I've heard. To want or to will the good of another.
Mm.
And that means a bunch of different stuff. Like, so say I walk in home today and my son hasn't done his homework. And I call him over. I go, why didn't you do your homework? And he goes, I don't know. I didn't have time. Or I was playing video games or something. And then we figure out how we're going to deal with that. I go, well, I'm not going to give you extra time to do your homework because you had till 9 because that's bedtime. So you're going to show up to school tomorrow and you're going to have to deal with not meeting your responsibilities. Because why would I do that? Why wouldn't I sit there and say, I'm going to give you an extra 2 hours today, even though you wasted your time playing video games, to do your homework so that you show up tomorrow and then you can say, yeah, I finished my homework. Or like for me to finish your homework for you. Because I'm not willing you're good. Like I want you to grow up. You're 9 now, but there's a day you're going to be 17 and there's a day you're going to be 25 and you're going to like stay up till 3 a.m. and have to get up and go to work in the morning and nobody's going to be there to cover for you.
Mm.
You got to be responsible. So I'm willing his good at 9 years old of what he's going to be like when he's 25 and 35 and whatever.
Mm.
That's love. I'm loving him. He's not going to like it in the moment. He's going to look at it and be like, Dad, like you're being very cruel to me. Why didn't you let me finish my homework? And whatever, I got docked grades or whatever like that. Like, I don't care you got docked grades. For me, that doesn't matter.
Mm.
Like you show up to me and you're like, I got a D. And I'm like, did you do your best? Yes, I did. And I know you did. Like, dude, I'll post that on my fridge. That's the best D because you gave it your all.
Wow.
So I'm like willing the good for my kids. Mm. And I'll get in a fight with my wife because I'm willing her good. Not all fights are bad. Right? Like not all arguments are bad. There's arguments I walk away from and I'm like, man, like I love that guy more now. He's made me love him more. And that's the same way with my wife. That's the same way with my kids. Now, if I show up and he hasn't done his homework, but I know like he got home from work, from school, he ate, he did homework, he went to soccer practice, he got back, he showered, he did more homework, and he's still not done, my response is not going to be the same.
Yeah.
I'm like, dude, here's an extra hour, do your homework.
Yeah.
Because he's trying, and I'm willing his good. So
I see what you're saying.
Like, that's the purpose of life, man. Like, and I'm reflecting God,
mm-hmm.
and I know when to show grace, and I know when to discipline. It's not a cookie cutter approach to, like, parenting, to loving.
Of course, of course.
Some people you rebuke. Some people you show grace to. And God's that way with me. Mm. Sometimes I do stupid stuff and I go to God and I'm like, I shouldn't even talk. Because I know better. I know what's right and wrong. And I've just done this because I wanted to do it.
We've all been
because it felt good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think God kind of looks at me and goes, okay, going to try better tomorrow.
Mm.
Because he loves me, because he's my dad, right? Like, I'm already forgiven in Christ. I'm just owning up to my stupidity. And sometimes I do stuff and he disciplines me. And he goes, you need to learn your lesson.
Yeah.
Because that's what's best for you. You need to be more disciplined.
Mm.
It's like, oh, man, I didn't show up to work on multiple occasions and they ended up firing me. God, why did you let them fire me? And God's like, because you need to learn your lesson, dude. Like, you keep doing the same thing over and over again.
Right.
You're irresponsible. You're lazy. X, Y, and Z. And so, like, I say that because the Christian life and the way I view apologetics is like that. I don't view apologetics like a lot of other people view apologetics, as in like it's just arguments. Apologetics for me is a defense of the Christian worldview and way of life. Mm. It's the way we think and process information and the way we live. That's what I'm defending. So I always ask question. I'll ask this question to people. Would you think the world would be a better place without Christianity? I need an answer for that. Well, yeah, I think the world would be a way better place without Christianity. Okay, cool. Give me the reasons why you think that. Because it seems to me, and in my reading, plenty of historians think like Christianity is a net positive for the world. Mm. Everywhere we've gone and planted churches, we've built educational institutions. The best educational institutions we have were originally Bible colleges. Go check them out. The oldest universities on the planet were Christian institutions raising theologians. Like St. Andrews, I think, is the oldest university in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Go to Oxford. Go to Harvard. USC was a Bible college. Like, it was a Wesleyan Bible college that had one major. Mm. Right? Like, not that we don't have secular institutions, because we do. But like hospitals and orphanages. Like, why do so many hospitals and orphanages have a Saint so-and-so in front of them? And not something else? Oh, because Christianity's had a net positive on the world. So people go like, why should we become Christian? For me, you ask the personal question. Because I think I'm a better citizen. If you go and you deal, if you're dealing with people, and generally you can say this, even people who are like pretty religious and live by a strict code, like you're probably going to be more comfortable with someone if you just know they're religious. Because you go, probably they're like, they have a fear of a higher authority, and so they're not going to cheat me in X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
But if you get to know people closer, you go, oh man, this guy really cares a lot. And like, he's going to do this, this, this. If he told me he fixed my car, then he did.
Yeah.
That's just the reality of life. I'm not saying that's always right. And I'm not saying it's always right to say, well, this person's not religious, so therefore I'm not going to trust them. Because they might not be religious, but be very honorable as people.
Yeah.
And somebody could be religious and just be a scumbag.
Yeah.
I'm just generalizing here. It's not an argument. I'm just saying this is the way people live their lives.
Breaking this down right now, though. I think you're making
it is the reality of existence.